I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Army Specialist Alexis Hutchinson is a soldier and a single mom, and her unit headed to Afghanistan earlier this month. She did not go, saying she could not find adequate child care for her son, and now she faces desertion charges. Is this a story about bureaucratic intransigence or personal responsibility? We'll talk with Specialist Hutchinson's lawyer about this in a few minutes. But first, it's time for our weekly political chat. President Obama has been overseas all week, and back here at home, his ticket's one-time rival has taken over the airwaves. Sarah Palin, the former Republican vice presidential candidate and former governor of Alaska. A little more than a year since the 2008 election, Sarah Palin is back on the national scene, not as a candidate, but as an author promoting her memoir, Going Rogue, An American Life. The book was a bestseller even before it hit the stands, and Palin, as during the campaign, has been followed by adoring crowds and intense media interest. But what does it mean? Polls show that a majority of Americans say they would never vote for her for president. But is she running? And whatever the polls say now, could she be a viable candidate? And what role is the media in all its varied forms, conservative, the blogosphere, the so-called mainstream, playing in all this? Because Palin is such a unique and controversial figure, we decided to focus our conversation today with those on her end of the political spectrum, with two conservatives. Mary Kate Carey is a former White House speechwriter for former President George H.W. Bush, or Bush 41. She now writes opinions for U.S. News and World Report, and she blogs there. We also have with us Matthew Continetti, who is the author of the new book, The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we jump into the political side of the discussion, I wanted to talk about Sarah Palin as a cultural figure. Mary Kate, why do you think we are so intrigued with her?
You know, I think it's because she's kind of an enigma to so many people. She's a walking contradiction in a lot of ways. She wanted to take time off from being governor to make a difference. And yet, you know, I read the papers daily. I couldn't tell you a single policy of hers. And it doesn't seem to me with this book, at least so far on page 50, that it's any sort of a policy book. She's in some ways, she reminds me of Princess Diana when Diana said, I want to be the queen of hearts. And yet there was this persistent anti-media, you know, I hate the paparazzi kind of thing.
But I love the paparazzi because they love me.
Right. Which, you know, a lot of ways people thought the paparazzi ended up kind of causing her death. And so it's very interesting. She accuses the mainstream media of lying, and yet there's a whole crowd that thinks she does nothing but lie. It's fascinating. Part of it, too, is people are curious about Alaska. And what would it be like to be up from there? And it does take a different type of person to live in darkness that many months of the year. And how would that be if you were, you know, living that life and then bursting onto the national scene?
So there's so many things that we're intrigued about, you think.
Matthew,
what's your take? What do you think?
Well, I think Sarah Palin is become a lens for how people view politics. And she kind of refracts the different ways that conservatives and liberals see the world. I think her supporters look at her and they see someone who is more or less an everyday American, someone who talks like they do, someone who thinks like they do, someone with no pretensions to intellectual grandeur or whatever. And they like that about her. And then I think her detractors look at her and they see someone who has no place in American life because she does not have expert knowledge, because she's very frank about her faith, and because she doesn't really subscribe to, the whole menu of what it means to be a feminist in American society.
You think she's kind of a Rorschach test, that when we see her, it sort of raises things about ourselves?
Absolutely, yes. And that's why, as I try to document in my book, there was this huge kind of rush to judgment and rush to print whatever the press could find about her, even though so many of the facts that they printed and reported turned out to be untrue.
Well, I want to hear more about the book, obviously, and your take on why you think she's being persecuted, which I think is a very, very strong word. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute. But Mary Kate, I'm going to go back to you because you wrote a piece for the U.S. News and World Report website. It's titled Moderate Republican Women and the Sarah Palin Dilemma. And you say that you'll note that many of the loudest opinions are coming from men. Matthew, we're not calling you loud. I'm just clarifying that. But for me and for a lot of moderate to conservative women, it's been interesting to watch. None of us are saying much. And you say we want to like her. There aren't many female Republican leaders we can root for, so we want to turn on one of our own. And you mention all the ways in which she's an attractive figure, the fact that she shoots, she has five kids, that she's trying to balance a complicated life. And you said, but she's made it difficult. So talk to me a little bit about your Sarah Palin dilemma.
Yeah, I didn't start writing until January when Obama was sworn in. So I got kind of a free pass on the campaign coverage. So that was nice because I could sit back and sort of watch this whole thing unfold. I think a lot of women, at least here in Washington, like me, sort of center-right women, are sitting on their hands and kind of listening and watching this whole thing. We don't want to turn on a woman. When we see some of the things that Matthew has documented in his book, how the mainstream media has gone after her, the immediate thought is, why on earth would a moderate to conservative Republican woman want to run for office when you see the way she's been treated and some of the other women on the right? But she's made it difficult for us to stand up and root for her because she comes from a rural state, for example. They don't have traffic. They don't have crime. They don't have some of the concerns we have here on the East Coast. She does have this sort of far-right rhetoric that is not common ground, you know, the consensus-building type of women that I sort of hang around with here in Washington are sort of appalled by that. The whole tabloid celebrity Levi in Playgirl magazine, you know, we're all sort of cringing, like, oh, gosh, you know, this is not the person that we want kind of speaking for us. But we want to root for her. She's not our father's GOP, and that's got a lot of appeal. So it's conflicted.
It's conflicted. And you said you're digging into the book now, so we might need to invite you back after Thanksgiving to when you finished it to see what you think. Matthew, you have also written a book about Sarah Palin, and you say that she's being persecuted. Now, for me, persecuted, you know, means shot at, detained. It means being arrested for your political views. It doesn't mean the honor of being invited to be the top of the ticket for your political party. It doesn't mean resigning from a job for which you campaigned and then, you know, earning millions on the book tour and being invited on, like, the most important television news program. So tell me why you think she's been persecuted.
Right. Well, persecution means an attempt to drive out, attempt to subjugate. And there are various ways that that can be done. And I believe, and as I write in the book, I think I have a lot of evidence for it, that Palin's opponents and her critics would like to see her leave the public square. They want to drive her out. And the way that they do this is by insulting, degrading, demeaning, abusing, and ridiculing her, and by pretending that she has nothing to say.
Well, can I ask you, though, more about this? And I'm going to play, I mean, obviously one of the big sort of I don't know, if maybe this is a Rorschach test moment, is this whole exchange she had with Katie Couric, where Katie Couric asked her, what does she like to read to keep in touch with issues? And she was clearly offended by the question. Oprah asked her about the question on her interview program earlier this week. And let's just play the exchange. You can hear what she had to say. Here it is.
By the time she asked me that question, even though it was kind of early on in the interview, I was already so annoyed, and it was very unprofessional of me to wear that annoyance on my sleeve. But
was
it was like
that you couldn't think of any in the moment?
No, or you were... it was more like, are you kidding me? Are you really asking me? To me, it was in the context of, do you read? It seemed like she was discovering this nomadic tribe, a member of a tribe from some Neanderthal cave in Alaska, asking me, how do you stay in touch with the real world?
Yeah, you know, Matthew, do you think that's an example of her being persecuted? Was she being persecuted by Katie Couric? Because I have to tell you, and forgive me for just putting my own things, that as a White House correspondent, I covered President George H.W. Bush. We always asked him, what are you reading right now? And he would always tell us. And I don't recall him taking umbrage at that.
Well, Michelle, when you read my book, you'll see that I actually say that the Katie Couric interview was a lousy interview. It was a terrible interview. Palin did not perform as she should have. And Palin admits that now. I find it interesting, though, as I talk about my book and, of course, talk about her book, that really the basis of the anti-Palin case comes down to two things, that Katie Couric interview and really what people think of Sarah Palin when they think of her, they're really thinking of the Tina Fey impression of her. And the fact is, Katie Couric interview, yeah, it was bad, but it was one interview. And I think that there's a much broader record with Palin and also many more interviews with Palin that it should be set into context, that have a context around it.
Like what?
Well, like her record of reform in Alaska, for example, like the fact that she took on the Republican establishment there, like the fact that she got through three major reforms through the Alaska state legislature, like the fact that it seems to me, just look at her current tour right now. I think she's performing very well in these interviews. She's not a dummy. She has opinions. But she has policies.
But is the question whether she's a dummy? Here's my question: is she was not running for vice president of the Republican Party. She was not running for vice president of the conservative movement. Given that, and particularly given that it was a very short general election campaign, an 8-week campaign, given that she was running for president of the country, why isn't it reasonable for people to subject her to whatever test for fitness they may have to lead the entire country? Why isn't that reasonable?
I don't argue that in my book. You can subject anyone to any test you'd like. But I don't think that excuses the printing of just false information about a vice presidential candidate, nor do I think it excuses the vitriol that was directed at Sarah Palin on the blogs and in liberal commentary. Using the most heated and demeaning terms that if they were used on any other political figure, the writers who used them would be denounced.
Mary Kay, talk to me about that. And we have a minute left, and we're going to come back after a short break and continue our conversation. So never fear. You'll have a chance to finish your thought. But what do you think?
I have to agree with Matthew that the vitriol took me aback. And for example, when Maureen Dowd wrote that Sarah Palin was Caribou Barbie, I winced because I thought, wait, you know, why are you going after a woman like that? I know she's on the other side of the political spectrum, but I thought that was, you know, surprisingly personal. It wasn't going after on a policy or anything like that. And I sort of thought, this is ugly and not necessary. And let's talk issues and substance. And that didn't seem to happen at all in the campaign.
As I said, we need to take a short break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion about Sarah Palin. We'll talk about whether or not she is a viable candidate for president in the 2012 election, if she even wants to be. We'll return with Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. He's also the author of a new book about Sarah Palin and the media. And Mary Kate Carey, she's a former Republican speechwriter who writes opinions for U.S. News and World Report and blogs at their site. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the Barbershop Guys give their take on the end of Oprah's broadcast television show. We'll see if the guys are heartbroken and get their take on the other news of the week. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about the political and cultural phenomenon that is Sarah Palin. We're joined by Matthew Continetti. He's an associate editor at the Weekly Standard. He's also the author of the new book, The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. We're also joined by Mary Kate Carey. She's a former White House speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, and she also blogs and writes opinions for U.S. News and World Report, and they're both here with me. Thank you again for staying with us. Now, before the break, we were talking about Sarah Palin and the media, and I think we could probably spend another hour talking about topic, but I wanted to focus on her political future and talk about a possible run for the White House. Matthew, you wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week that Ms. Palin has two problems. The first is that she's become one of the most polarizing figures in the country. The second is that voters continue to worry about her qualifications for the presidency, a concern that her abrupt resignation from office last July intensified. Lucky for her, both problems are solvable. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, do you think she is running, and do you think she is still a viable candidate?
Well, I don't think Palin knows whether she's running. As I researched and reported on Palin's career and life, she's a very impulsive political figure. And that leads to decisions like the one of her resignation last July. So I don't know if she knows, and I think she'll probably come to a decision after the midterms. If she does decide to run, I think she has a strong gut connection with Republican primary voters. I think they have passionate opinions about her to the extent that they really don't with some of her other potential rivals. But her bigger problem, rather than connecting with the Republican base, which I think she does, her bigger problem is convincing independents that she's up to the job. And right now, independents are divided on her, and more independents disapprove of her than approve of her. I think the gap is bridgeable. It's anywhere between 7 to 12 points. And as we see with other political figures, public perceptions can change over time.
The question I have is she good for the party in the sense that, you know, there are some candidates that a lot of people are excited by. Like, for example, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton are exciting to some members of the Democratic coalition, but they're very polarizing figures for others. And so the question becomes, does the benefit of their galvanizing force outweigh the sort of the repulsion that other people have for them? And so that's my question about Sarah Palin. Matthew?
Yeah, sure. It's unanswerable at the moment, because really the only test of these things is an election. And at this point, if the election were held today, Palin would lose.
Mary Kate, what do you think about this? And you said in your piece, which again, we'll have a link to it on our site so that people can read it in its entirety, because I think it's very interesting. I think it speaks for the conflicted feelings a lot of people have. You said, we want to like her. There aren't many female Republican leaders we can root for, and we don't want to turn on one of our own. She is in many ways, like many of us, on the younger side of middle age, house full of kids, works part to full time, not your father's GOP. And yet, what do you think? Is she still a viable candidate? And if she wants to remain in political life, not just public life, are her electoral problems fixable?
Where I come down on this is, what I'm sick of hearing as a Republican woman is that the Republican Party has become the party of white, male, Southern, you know, it's become a regional party, all this sort of stuff. She is not white, male. Well, she's white, but she's not male or Southern. And she brings a different part of the party to the coalition from the West and women and things like that. So in that sense, I think she's good for the Republican Party. But I have to agree, she's an incredibly polarizing figure. I think independents like her because of her anti-establishment bent.
We'll hear what you have to say after you've read her book. And we're going to read Matthew, we're going to read your book too.
I hope so.
Mary Kay Carey is a former White House speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's a columnist and an opinion writer and a blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Matthew Continetti is an associate editor of the Weekly Standard. He's the author of the new book, The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. And I also want to mention he's an occasional visitor to our Loyal Opposition Roundtable, and he joined us from Washington, D.C. also. I thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Now we turn to another very different story about women in leadership. First Lady Michelle Obama and the wife of the Vice President, Jill Biden, revived a tradition begun by former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt this week, hosting a tea to showcase the accomplishments of military women and the wives of men in the service. The First Lady took a moment to recognize women she said had broken the brass ceiling.
In this room alone, we have the first female four-star general. We have the first woman in the Navy to be promoted to Master Chief. The first woman in the Army Reserve to be promoted to the general officer rank. We have the first woman in the Army to receive the expert field medical badge. We have the first African American woman to serve as chief nurse at Walter Reed Hospital. And so many more firsts and onlys. And that's the result of your hard work and your courage and your persistence.
But even as women reach new heights and rank in the military, the service is still grappling with some of the realities of the way people live today, in which women may be service members and parents, and not just parents, but single parents. The latest available data from the Defense Department counts more than 20,000 single moms on active duty. There are nearly 50,000 men who are. And right now, one of those mothers is struggling to balance her obligation to the armed forces with her obligation to her child. Army Specialist Alexis Hutchinson is a 21-year-old single mother who expected her mother to care for her 10-month-old son, Kamani, when her unit deployed. But her mother changed her mind. Now her military career may be in jeopardy. She could face desertion charges, and her son could go to temporary foster care. Hutchinson's civilian attorney, Ray Sue Sussman, joins us now to talk more about this case. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, I think most people expect that a service member who faces deployment should have a plan in place. Did Specialist Hutchinson have such a plan in place, and what happened?
She did have a plan, and in anticipation, she had taken her baby Kamani to stay with her own mother for the duration of her deployment. However, after a week of caring for him on her own, Specialist Hutchinson's mother found herself overwhelmed and backed out and said that she couldn't take him for the long period of a 12-month deployment after all.
Can you tell us why she felt so overwhelmed?
She has a lot of other family responsibilities. She also has a daughter of her own who has health problems and special needs. she had found out that her sister, Specialist Hutchinson's aunt, had just found out that she had some serious health problems, and the aunt had asked Alexis Hutchinson's mother for extra help in the upcoming months.
So what happened then after she did take the child initially and she determined after a week that she just felt she was not up to that responsibility? What happened?
She informed Specialist Hutchinson, who informed her command, and she was given an extension to try to find someone else. However, shortly before she deployed, she was told that she would not get that extension after all and that she would need to find someone to care for her child within 24 hours, and she needed to be on the plane. Because she was scared and didn't want to abandon her child, even though she knew it was wrong to disobey orders, she felt that she could not get on that plane. However, within a day, Specialist Hutchinson returned to Army control with her child, and that is when the Army arrested her, put her in jail, and took her infant away from her.
What charges is Specialist Hutchinson facing?
She has not been charged yet. But we have been told that she is facing a special court-martial for charges of missing movement, AWOL, desertion, and I believe that is it.
Now, there's been some dispute about whether she was, in fact, granted an extension in order to find appropriate care for her son. You're saying she was not granted an extension to come up with more time, to come up with a better plan.
It is complicated. She was initially granted an extension, and she thought she had until mid-November or late November. However, a day before she deployed, she was told that she was not getting that extension after all.
Hmm. What do you think should happen now? And you have to know that this case has gotten quite a lot of attention in the days since Specialist Hutchinson was arrested. And there are some who say that this is absurd, that any parent who works understands that sometimes child care plans fall through. And you just cannot anticipate everything in life. But others say that you cannot enlist in the military while this country is fighting two wars, particularly in the area in which she is serving, and not expect to deploy and not expect to have a plan in place.
Right. Specialist Hutchinson fully understood that she was going to deploy. I think this is an example of how overstressed the military is to treat this baby and mother in a less than understanding way solely to get enough boots on the ground in Afghanistan. And this particular chain of command, I believe, handled the situation without using the discretion and fairness that they have under military law to handle these cases individually. And in a case like this, when you have a young infant involved, I believe that they really should have more understanding of the difficult situation that military parents face.
What about, is there a father in the picture? Does Kamani have a father who is in a position to care for the child?
Kamani, there's no one with paternity rights over Kamani. And again, we have a very young Army, and I think that probably Alexis Hutchinson is not the only one in this situation.
What are your next steps here?
I'm, working to try to persuade the Army. We're in conversation to see if the Army will, is open at all to administratively discharging her with a general under honorable conditions, given the situation that she faced and the punishment she's already undergone. In my experience, it is extremely unusual for someone who returns voluntarily after less than a day of being AWOL to have their liberty constrained by being placed in jail, by having their child taken from them, and even the restrictions she's had since she got out of jail about a week and a half ago have been pretty harsh by Army standards. The Army told me last week that when they took the baby that he was going into foster care. I've since discovered that they actually did not, as far as I can understand, have Child Protective Services involved, and they basically took the baby and placed it in a daycare on base, which I'm not sure is authorized.
And I understand and I appreciate this, but I also have to press the question. There are those who would argue she knew when she undertook this job
which she was not required to do. There is not a draft in the United States. She chose this particular line of work, that this particular line of work has particular responsibilities. And I think the question that some would have, did she in good faith expect to fulfill those responsibilities or not? And if she did she take appropriate steps to ensure that she could fulfill her responsibilities?
Alexis did join. I mean, she was very into the military. She was in the junior ROTC for 3 years in high school in Oakland and joined the Army right out of high school and hasn't had any disciplinary problems. She did plan on deploying, and this fell through, and she felt that she was not treated fairly when the situation came up. I think that it reflects poorly on our Army's ability to manage and respect own troops and support its own troops.
Ray Sue Sussman is the civilian attorney representing Specialist Alexis Hutchinson. Ray Sue Sussman joined us from her home office in California. Ms. Sussman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with us as usual. Hi, Lee. What's up?
Hey, Michelle. This week we received some critical feedback for our parenting segment on how working mothers are sometimes frowned upon in custody battles. Here's a clip from that conversation with family attorney Shantice Curry Try.
We've abolished the 10 to years doctrine, which basically says that there is a motherly preference in the courts. When a mother decides to step outside her box, which is the cooking and cleaning and taking care of the kids, and actually decide to do something outside of the home, she is held to a higher standard of scrutiny when it comes to custody cases.
And Michelle, many listeners wished our conversation had included a male perspective, but that wasn't the only criticism. Here's a note from John. He writes, I think it's obnoxious that your host and guests have the audacity to presume that now that men and women are getting equal treatment in custody assessments, it's somehow a punishment of moms working and not playing the traditional mom role. I am a working father, I am married to a working mother, and we work very well together. But if that were to go south, I'm comforted by the fact that I will be given the same custody consideration as my children's mother.
John, we thank you for writing, but I'm going to push back on this. I'm going to point out that this conversation was not based on a presumption. It was based on reporting and the experiences of those offering their views, and there is a difference. You can agree with it or disagree with it, but that's what it was, and I invite listeners to listen again to the conversation if they want to understand this issue further from the perspective of those who were discussing it. And now on to another important topic. We received some very personal stories in response to the controversial new guidelines issued by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. That's an independent panel of experts appointed by the Department of Health and Human Services. And the task force said that women can now wait an additional 10 years before getting an annual mammogram. They should start at age 50, the panel said, instead of age 40, and that most women, ages 50 to 74, can even skip a year between exams. Here's Dawn. This is what she had to say.
At age 40, I had my first mammogram and then an ultrasound, which revealed invasive cancer. I had no symptoms and no risk factors for breast cancer. I don't care what the statistics show. You cannot put a value of my life into a statistic.
Well, Don, we thank you very much for sharing your story with us and our very best wishes to you.
Well, Michelle, we heard from another online commenter, Trina, who takes another perspective. She agrees with the agency guidelines.
I'm happy that I no longer have to endure the stress of being pinched, prodded, and stuck unnecessarily because of a false positive exam. I think that the reasoning behind the new recommendation is because of people with what we call my family lumpy breast, where we end up going through weeks of agony thinking that you might have breast cancer when in fact you just had lumpy breast.
And Michelle, another commenter, is just unsure about the whole thing. Here's Lynn expressing her concerns.
I believe in math and statistics, and I still haven't made up my mind. I'm not technically in a high-risk group, no family history, but I am overweight, and I know that increases my risk. I think I should continue to have my annual exam, but what will my insurance company say? That concerns me.
Well, according to Kathleen Sebelius, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Lynn, she says, don't stop doing what you're doing. The Cabinet Secretary issued a statement earlier this week saying, quote, mammograms have always been an important life-saving tool in the fight against breast cancer, and they still are today. Keep doing what you have been doing for years and make the decision that is right for you. And on Monday, we're going to continue talking about this issue, so I want to thank all of our listeners for weighing in and sharing their stories and concerns and questions. And thank you, Lee, for updates.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our new website, where you can read more from fellow listeners and enjoy a simpler social networking experience. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and NPR's own political editor Ken Rudin. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Jimmy.
Hey.
Doing good, man. Hey.
Hey, man, making it do what it do. Well, uh-oh, she's back. That's right. While President Obama was away this week hobnobbing in Asia, guess who decided to step back into the spotlight? Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. She is...
Palin, as in Palin Place? Were you having a moment?
Right, exactly. She's promoting her book, and as it happens, she's around my way. And if I wasn't on the show, I'd probably be camped out trying to get my copy.
Yep.
Of going rogue. Michelle, what do you think about that?
I don't know, Ken, what do you think about that? I guess the question I think a lot of us have is, do you think she's really running? Is she testing the waters for another political career?
Well, you mean on Earth? Well, yeah. see, the problem is, I mean, Jimmy says she's back. She's never left. I mean, the thing is, of course, she has this book, Going Rogue. And, of course, that was the title that the McCain people gave her because McCain the Maverick didn't like the fact that Sarah Palin was even more of a maverick. So, you know, the book, there's some things about the book that you almost feel for her. The abuses that she took about her children, I think the over the top questions about whether it was her real child or not, something. I mean, some of the questions were really beyond the pale. But when it comes down to the basic questions, why did you resign as governor of Alaska, as Peyton would say? Why couldn't you answer the Katie Couric question about what books or magazines or lawn signs you may have read in your life? There were so many things that she didn't answer. So you think that ultimately she is leading towards a 2012 candidacy. You saw her involvement in that upstate New York congressional seat where she played a major role in marshaling conservative support. And yet on basic questions, she still doesn't seem to have the kind of answers one would expect in a presidential candidate.
Hmm. Ruben, what do you think?
I think she's a fascinating person to watch. And whether you love her or hate her, people can't look away from her. I think it's one of the reasons that she's going to generate all this money and has generated money in books and speaking fees and the like. People, even media outlets that don't like her, and I happen to work for one of them, I think it's fair to say CNN does not have a positive opinion of Sarah Palin. And yet when you go onto the website, you see that her stories are prominently displayed because everybody makes money from Sarah Palin, even people who don't like her, because we have this fascination with her. I think one of the most important things to come out of the debate, frankly, was what we learned about class differences and elitism. And interestingly enough, the one defender that Sarah Palin had of note was Bill Clinton, who doesn't agree with her politically on many issues. But Clinton said to the elitists in the Democratic Party and around the country, he said, you know, I got the same sort of treatment in 1992 when people saw me coming from Arkansas. This is really dangerous stuff, he says, because what you are missing is that there's a reason that 20,000, 30,000 people show up at rallies for Sarah Palin. And I think that was a very profound thing for Clinton to say, because I remember in the day in 92 when Clinton was first running and first gone national, Paul Tsongas, Jerry Brown, his opponents, they all sort of like put him off as coming from the backwoods and come on and all this other stuff, Jennifer Flowers and all this. And I think that Clinton was hitting on something really important, which is we have a tendency as Americans to look down on one another. And just like folks looked down and underestimated Bill Clinton, so they are estimating Sarah Palin.
Okay, but that gives the lie to the notion that this is somehow because she's a Christian, conservative, you know, evangelical. I mean, because you're saying there's there's a double standard. It's a double standard because I'm a Christian. It's a double standard because I'm a woman. Bill Clinton is a Christian, but he's not a conservative Christian. He's not a woman. And yes, it is true. He had to face some of the same questions. And the other thing that I would point out that is that, you know, her chief antagonists are within her own party. The people who first started leaking negative and critical information about her were people who were on the ticket that selected her.
Absolutely.
So I guess I just think that, you know, what's the issue here that nobody's allowed to – anyway, Arslan, you want to get into this. Well, Arslan's giving us these really weird – like he can't decide like if he just wants her to go away or
– I mean, I can decide. I mean, I am completely sick and tired of hearing about Sarah Palin, and I think that, you know, there are many people
– Hater.
Listen, I think there
socialist.
There are a lot of people, you know, who, you know, again, you know, she essentially is a political has-been in the sense that, you know, we didn't see Lloyd Bentsen come out after, you know, he lost, you know, as the vice presidential candidate. But and more importantly, you know, you talk about all this, you know, hateration against Sarah Palin. I think it revolves around the fact that in terms of political substance, she has about as much political substance as Ken Rudin's pinky finger. And now, you know, she's going on her little honky-tonk badonkadonk book tour, you know, promoting her book. You know, she's making money.
How dare you insult my pinky finger?
Sorry, she has a right to make money.
No, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that, you know, for someone who can see Russia from the back porch of their house, you know, it's interesting.
Tina Fey said that.
What?
You know what? You know what?
She never said that. Tina Fey said that.
Right.
But she did say, well, in one of her interviews with, I can't remember whether it was with Barbara Walters or Oprah Winfrey, she did, I think it was with Barbara Walters who talked more political topics with her. She did talk about her credential being Alaska's proximity to Russia. She actually kind of defended the concept. Anyway, Jimmy, you were trying to say something.
I was just saying, A-Train, you know, you're really hard on Sarah Palin. I don't know that anybody's going to mistake me for a Sarah Palin supporter, but you know what? Don't count her out because her appeal was also her Achilles heel. Her appeal is that everybody knows Sarah Palin. They know a Sarah Palin. She's the neighbor. She's that woman at the beauty salon. She might even be the cashier at the Piggly Wiggly. You know, but the problem is the cashier at the Piggly Wiggly probably wouldn't run, you know, on the Republican ticket as the vice presidential candidate. And for me, she was thrown in by the McCain camp as kind of this, it was a convenience thing. She wasn't prepped properly, but I don't know. I wouldn't sleep on her. I wouldn't sleep on her in 2012 because she taps into that every person, every man, every woman quality that a lot of people want back in the White House.
Except, I agree with you on that in terms of her personal biography. But where she doesn't tap into that every man, every woman quality is with a lack of empathy. I mean, she has this very unusual biography, but she seems to have little interest in people whose biographies are unusual. The way she ridiculed Barack Obama as a community organizer, for example, saying, I was a small town mayor. I guess that's like being a community organizer with actual responsibilities. What if he'd been a missionary? Would she have ridiculed him? What if he had been a missionary and doing the same thing a community organizer does?
Empathy's so important. Michelle, but there's a lot of folks out there. I could list 10 off the top of my head, successful Democratic politicians who lack empathy. And I think that's not necessarily a disqualifier. What's always bothered me is the double standard. I mean, we'll go forward in the media and say, you know, she got all these things wrong. But every time Joe Biden made a flub or a mistake or just, you know, flat out said Teddy Roosevelt went on Franklin Delano Roosevelt went on television, you know, then people like Clarence Page, my friend at the Chicago Tribune, would shrug and say, oh, that's just Joe.
I don't agree with you. How do you know about these flubs? It's because people wrote about it. Anyway, Ken wanted to get into
this. Plus the fact that if we're talking about her lack of empathy, well, take a look at another vice presidential candidate, John Edwards, who faked empathy, who talked about his empathy towards women, and you saw what he was doing to women behind his back. I think there's a real
– Who is the only national politician less – favorably approved of than Sarah Palin.
But a long time. But Arslan talked about her as a has-been. When John Edwards' ticket lost in 2004, he wasn't a has-been. He was a front-runner for 2008 until somebody like Hillary and Barack Obama came along.
Well, until you cheat on your cancer-stricken wife.
Exactly.
There's a lack of empathy
and there's fake empathy, and I don't know which one is worse.
Well, so anyway, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with Jimmy Israel, Arslan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, and Ken Rudin. Can I just ask briefly, are you guys going to read the book?
No.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I'm totally going to read it.
Absolutely.
Jimmy, yes. So. Jimmy, yes. Ken, yes. Arslan, no. Ruben, what about you?
No.
No? Really?
No.
How come?
I mean, no. I'm defending her, but I mean, you know, you're asking me if I'm interested in the subject matter. I think we understand what's in this book already. I think if you pay attention to enough interviews, you're getting a lot of what's in the book.
I'm going to read it. Ken, you going to let me borrow your copy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. Because, yeah, you know, times are still tough around here. Anyway, Jimmy, you had something else you wanted to talk about.
Well, you know what? Earlier this week, Attorney General Eric Holder defended his decision to try 5 co-conspirators in the 9/11 attacks in a civilian court in New York. Michelle?
Yeah, should so the question is, of course, should he be tried in civilian court? And do you think that, I mean, obviously this is causing all kinds of angina with people who think, and Arsalan, of course, you're our civil rights attorney in the mix, and the question is this the appropriate venue, and does this expose this, whatever venue is selected for a trial, does it expose them to additional risks, and are those risks warranted by whatever principle is at issue by holding a civilian trial? So what's your take on this?
Those are very good questions, Michelle. And generally speaking, within the American legal system, both civilian criminal trials and military criminal trials are essentially the same except for the rules of evidence. You know, the matters of military criminal justice are usually governed by the Universal Code of Military Justice, or the UCMJ. Now, let's not forget that there are five other people who are going to be tried in military commissions for the attack on the USS Cole in 2000 in Yemen. And so essentially what the sort of philosophy that the Justice Department is taking is civilian trial for civilian crimes or civilian victims and military trials for military victims. The USS Cole off the port of Sana'a, Yemen was a purely military target. Let's not forget Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not captured on the battlefield. He was actually arrested by Pakistani security forces in Rawalpindi, Pakistan. On an arrest warrant. And so, you know, to me it's funny, the argument that I always bring up to, you know, my conservative debaters when I do debate them is that had President Bush had, you know, decided that KSM and his, you know, four people were going to a civilian court, I hardly think we would be hearing a peep from the neoconservative crowd. I think they'd be touting, you know, how great our American justice system is. And if anybody challenged, you know, the veracity of that, you know, we probably would have been called unpatriotic. But now that we have, I think there is a double standard.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of a hypothetical. But let me just play a short clip from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Attorney General Eric Holder was called before the Senate Judiciary Committee to talk about the security risk, and this is what Lindsey Graham had to say. Here it is.
Under domestic criminal law, the moment the person is in the hands of the United States government, they're entitled to be told they have a right to a lawyer and can remain silent, and if we go down that road, we're going to make this country less safe. That is my problem with what you have done.
And I'll just play a short clip of Attorney General Eric Holder's response. Here it is.
I'm not going to base a determination on where these cases ought to be brought on what a terrorist, what a murderer wants to do. He will not select the prosecution venue. I will select it, and I have.
You know, one of the problems that kind of jumps out at me right here is that, Ruben, you talked about this. They've already convicted him in their public utterances.
Yes, they have.
So that raises some questions. I don't know, Ruben, if
here's the deal. I could make very easily the Lindsey Graham argument attacking this from the right. I think that exchange between Graham. Graham's a smart guy. I think Graham, that exchange with Holder was an important one. A lot of Americans don't like the idea. 70-80% of Americans don't like the idea of a Mirandizing. You have the right to remain silent, terrorism suspects. Okay, so that's, I think, a loser for Holder. But I'm going to take this on from the left, not from the right. The fact that during an NBC interview with Chuck Todd, the president would in China say that people are going to feel better about what happens to KSM when he is convicted and given the death penalty, okay, prejudging his guilt and the punishment, is problematic from a legal point of view. Already appeals are kind of coming up. The president's already done this, close the door.
Right, how do you get a fair trial?
And then a fair hanging, right?
Right.
So the point is, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? This whole fig leaf somehow that the reason they move on to civilian court is so they can have all these glorious, you know, U.S. protections, American protections in our judicial system. One of them is innocent until proven guilty. Obama just shot that to heck. The other thing is Holder went before Congress and said as a way – see Holder and Obama are being pushed by the right-wingers to be real hardline on this. And so what Holder said to Congress was, we will not let anybody go. Even if they're acquitted at trial, we're not going to let them go if we think they're a threat to Americans. Mm. So basically what you've said there now is due process out the window. So this thing's a joke, the fact that somehow you move KSM to civilian court, but then you summarily take away all his rights. So, I mean, what are we doing?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, both Ken and Arsalan wanted to get on this. Arsalan briefly, then Ken.
Well, Ruben, you bring up some great points. And the FBI has formed things called clean teams, essentially to look at the evidence that was procured before the 183 times that he was waterboarded. And so they obviously think that they have the evidentiary burden of proof to be able to get that conviction, which is one of the reasons why they're bringing him to civilian court. And most importantly, let's not forget that Ramzi Youssef, who was convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and who also also happens to be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, is already serving a life sentence in Supermax in Colorado in solitary confinement, and we haven't heard a peep from him since.
Arsal, let me push back on this a second. The civilian target business, this is a fig leaf, again, of the administration. Explain to me why on 9/11, when the Pentagon was attacked, the Pentagon is not a military target. You don't become a more military target than the Pentagon.
No, but again, KSM was not a member of any military. He was captured by civilian forces in Rawalpindi.
But you said it
Pakistan.
Had everything to do with the targets. You bought the holder line. That's
a
lie.
No.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. We need to give Ken a chance to get into this. And then
two quick things. First of all, Giuliani said the argument against having KSM tried is that suddenly New York City would become a major terrorist target, as if New York City is not a terrorist target anyway. And
Amen.
Two,
right.
Exactly. And two, that KSM would be allowed to have these talking points and would excite jihad all over the world. That's kind of ridiculous. But Rubin's point is. And it's not from the left, because I think the right should say the same exact thing. That remember when Richard Nixon, I think, convicted, was it William Calley or the Tate-LoBianca murders, and he said he's guilty, and everybody went ballistic. Barack Obama and Attorney General Holder have already convicted KSM, and there was so much for the right of a free trial.
And yesterday, and finally, just such a very different topic, but it is something that I know a lot of people want to talk about. Jimmy, I'm just going to ask you this. Yesterday, of course, the diva of divas, Oprah Winfrey, announced she's going to shut down her syndicated show that's shown on the networks all across the country in 2011 after 25 seasons on the air. Jimmy, I know you've been heartbroken about this, and I just wonder if there's any way you could possibly recover from this loss.
And go
on. I'm on record. I'm pretty down on Oprah as being, anti-black male, anti-family, and pro-Oprah. But that said, she brought something to the network that we hadn't ever seen before her. The reason she was able to kind of elbow Phil Donahue out the way is that she brought empathy and confessional TV into the zeitgeist. And, I don't know. We can argue whether that was a good thing or not. But I don't know who's going to take her place. I don't know if we need anybody to take her place, frankly.
Jimmy. Well, Jimmy Israel.
I'm glad that Jimmy approved that message because nobody else did. So.
Right. Hey. No,
somebody can take a place after Allen Iverson has a very successful career on the New York Knicks that will go on for at least 15 seconds. Then he could have his own talk show.
I was just down on the way. Oprah, she really didn't let people think for themselves, in my opinion.
Did she have truth serum coming through the airways?
Yeah, absolutely.
Please.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ruben. Final thought.
What you
got
to understand about Oprah is that she was told at the very beginning, 25-30 years ago, you're never going to have a career in television. You're the wrong color. You're overweight. All these things are a matter of fact. They come out in biographies about Oprah. And it's inspiring that she, lived by Evita Perón's 7-word mantra. It doesn't matter what the morons say, baby.
That's right.
I guess that's 8 words.
Viva Oprah.
Preach, Ruben. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist. He writes for CNN.com and the San Diego Union-Tribune. And he joined us from San Diego. We were also joined by Jimmy Israel, a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor, our political junkie, and they both joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much for joining us. I'm off next week to cook, so happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Peace. Gobble, gobble.
Speaking of being overweight and the wrong color, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks, our program.
Yep.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.